Good morning. Thank you all for coming. My name is Jacqueline Delaharp, and I'm the moderator. I personally have a really deep interest in food, maybe too much of an interest, but that's partly why we're here today with this panel. And I'm guessing that all of you, too, are really interested in this subject. Can you hear me? All right. Okay. I think food has really has a great power to create bonds between families. It links us to our social and cultural history. And now as a grass movement that's gaining ground, it is a phenomenal catalyst for change. The panel that's assembled here today has provocative perspectives on sustainable agriculture and what food systems change can mean for marginalized communities, immigrant labor, for example, and offers some perspective on national initiatives that support systems change, and even a corporation with national reach and a grassroots perspective. Today's panel from California, Oregon, that's me, New York, Florida, and who did I miss? No one? Good. I hope we'll provide a new frame and a really profound one for you to tell some environmental stories in your reporting. About agriculture, new ways to understand our food system and its power as a story to create change. So what I'm going to do is introduce the panelists, just a little bit of introduction, because I'm sure all of you have been careful to read their biographies, and you already know who they are. And then we'll go on and have a question and answer among the panelists, and then you'll have an opportunity to ask questions as well. So Rita, here on my left, lives in Oklahoma. She's a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, about 90 miles east of Tulsa. Is that a little bit too far? Okay. And she has helped to create the first tribal food policy council within her tribe as part of their government. And this action is really a model in Indian country for other tribes who want to take control of their food systems and provide physical and cultural nourishment for tribal people. And to her left is Kolu Zigbee, who's from New York City, and is a program officer for the Jesse Noyes Foundation, and has also, full disclosure, she has funded Rita's program. And she is known in the sustainable agriculture world as a woman who is serious, hardworking, and pays close attention to these issues, and she's very instrumental in philanthropy. Jordan Buckley there's Lionel, sorry. Lionel Perez, his first language is Spanish, and if you speak slowly, he will understand English. He understands English well, correct? Yes. And so when you're asking your questions, if you speak slowly, he will understand what you say, but we also have a translator who's working with him. Lionel is from Guatemala. He's first generation in this country, and he works for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to protect workers' rights. He is also a tomato field hand in other times when he is not working as an organizer. And then to his left is Jordan Buckley. He's a staff member with the Interfaith Action Group, which is a faith-based group that works with the Immokalee workers to help them voice their rights in English. And he's here as a translator for Lionel. And finally, at the end of the line, last but not least, is Helene York, who is with Bon Appetit, which is not a magazine, but a business-to-business group that began in 1987 as a catering group with a principled, sustainable agriculture ethic, and has then morphed into a $650 million organization that she'll talk more about that later, in the country, that was purchased by Compass Group in 2004, which is the largest food service organization in the world. And yet, they maintain their important sustainable principles of the principles of sustainability. So each of these panelists, I think, will bring a really great perspective for you to think about food systems and sustainable food systems and the triple bottom line, which is social capital, which is contributing to the common good, environmental capital, which is not taking more than you need, and financial capital, which is making a profit or earning a fair living wage. So the only other thing I'll say now is that the format is that each person here on the panel will have 5 minutes to talk about something that's very important to them. We'll spend time, about 20 minutes, talking as a panel about different questions. And then we'll have about 25 minutes or more, if it works out that way, for you to ask questions of the panelists. And you know the rules, I'm guessing, at this point about the asking questions. If you're an SEJ journalist and member of SEJ, you can ask questions first, and then the general audience, so that's probably, I don't know, six of you, come second. And please state your name and your affiliation, too. All right, so let's lead off with Rita. And here's the mic, and I'll have to speak into it.
This is my first trip to Miami, Florida, and I've only seen it from my hotel room, but it looks beautiful. I am a Muscogee Creek Nation. That's my tribe. We're 70,000 and growing now, and of course, we're matriarchal. We follow the lineage of our mothers. I am Alligator Clan, and my tribal town is Kazita. We come from the old countries, which we call it, of Alabama and Georgia. And I hope I can get everything here within 5 minutes, because there's so much to tell, but I'll try. To bring you up to currently where we are now as Native people, as Muscogee Creek Nation, a little bit about pre-removal. Our people were, at one period, agri people, and they farmed many, many acres and acres and acres of land, and they settled near rivers and creeks where there was water that would irrigate their systems. Everybody always had a position and a play in all this. They were hunters and gatherers. They come from a land that just flourished with all kinds of foods for living. When the Europeans came, they saw that there was a lot of land that our people lived on. They wanted the land, so they moved our people. And that was called the Trail of Tears. And whenever we got to Oklahoma, Oklahoma is barren land. So they completely came without anything. And you have to understand that in order to understand where we are now. They lost everything. They lost even a lot of their traditional ways. They had to make do to what was around them. There were no more large oak trees and a lot of the environments that they were used to. All they were about now was in survival mode. So to bring all that up to now is that we still have some of our languages. We still have some of our fires that our people brought with them. Our fires are centered around food. Corn is a symbolic feature around our ceremonial grounds, and it's a sacred food. Where we are right now, as far as a food revitalization, about 3 years back, I became involved with the Muscogee Food Sovereignty Initiative as a community educator, and now I'm policy. It put me out once again with my people to see who all was familiar with gardening, healthy foods. We did this because we knew that there were so many health disparities that our people were facing. We're not any different from any other impoverished community. It's that we're just ranked in there in whenever they talk about health care, amputees, diabetes, we're ranked high up there. So looking at that, we knew that there was this need to revitalize our food again. So when I jumped right in here as a pilot project with greenhouses and hoop houses, and another whole new meaning came open to me again. Well, not again, but it just came open to me about what our people were lacking in the area of being removed from the ancestor lands. They were agri people. All that was lost. Our foods, our identification. One thing that we maintain, though, and that's still on the perils of being extinct, and that's our language. So we're all about revitalization right now. But we saw the lack in our communities. Then policy came. Policy said, you're able to do this. You have to work with your tribal leaders once again to revitalize agriculture. If you're ever going to address the needs within your community, you're going to have to look at all these things that have brought you up to where you are now and try to do some healing process through all of this, but also educate and train. That's kind of where we are right now. So policy, working with all the stakeholders that are within our tribe to change the way that our people have eaten for years, encourage them to get back to the spirituality of the agriculture. What it brought to us was all about who we were as Native people. I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit because I know just I have about a minute. The one thing that has happened to us this year is that we suffered drought, and we weren't really able to produce in the state of Oklahoma. A lot of the cattle have been sold off. Our big farmers are selling those off. We're seeing a lot of environmental change. Our farmers are telling us, you know, there's no more roadrunners. There's no more, pollinators. We're losing our pollinators. This year we suffered the drought. And we had a lot of blue algae due to a lot of this dry, hot weather that we're having. There's a lot of seasonal changes that are happening. We used to see all the four seasons of fall, winter, summer, and spring. We are jumping completely from winter into summer now. So that's affecting our growing season. This year, we've lost some of the things that were traditional to us when we came to Oklahoma, which is possum grapes. Those are things that we live to, that as part of our traditional foods that we use in some of our cooking. This year, our medicine people, they use a lot of tubers and wild medicines, and I'm not even sure if they were able to find them this year because of the drought season. So those are things that I will connect with whenever I get back to Oklahoma and find these things out. What are we going to do for the future? That's my time.
Thank you, Rita. Mm-hmm.
Okay, my name is Kolu Zigbee, and I'm going to use my time to tell you who I am, and which is, includes what I do, where I work, and some stories, and then hopefully in the Q&A I'll be able to tell more stories, because I am a program officer at a foundation, and for the past almost 12 years I've been managing a portfolio of grants to nonprofit organizations working around the country for a more ecologically sustainable and socially just food system. And my full name is Gwazu Kolu Zigbee, and I grew up in the Bronx. My dad is from Liberia, and when I was 17, I traveled there, and also in college, I went to school in West Africa for a year and had the chance to do some research in my clan. My grandfather was the traditional chief of a very small village, and the people lived in the rainforest with very little road access, and semi-subsistence agriculture, and did some trading, but limited by their ability to carry stuff on their heads. And what I discovered was that, you know, people for the most part really know what's going on, and like they knew that they had this land and it was sustaining them. And that's an ecological and environmental issue, because it's about, can livelihoods be sustainable in your environment? And the problem with injustice and social inequity is that it puts people in a desperate situation. So the temptation then is to allow exploitation. And the issue really is about corporate externalizations of the costs of doing business so they can make profits, right? And that those externalities are environmental degradation and even destruction, and it's a whole continuum. And also eking profits off of labor and squeezing as tight as you can and being unjust in that way. And the two are related, you know. And So anyway, what happened in Liberia, in my family, they grew upland rice, dry rice farming in the rainforest, and it produces a nutty, round grain that's very nutritious. Well, what was USAID doing? They were saying, let's give the Liberian government free rice, bleached long grain rice. That became the status symbol, and it was used by the government to earn revenue. They get the free rice from the U.S. and sell it to their people, and their corrupt officials basically pocket the money. Now in Liberia, long grain rice that they call Uncle Ben's is a status symbol. They don't want to eat the upgrain stuff that my grandfather and the people there were able to grow surplus of and sell in the market, and that would be a sustainable food system. So that was learning about that as a young person. Was my entry point in reading Frances Moore LePay. She really, you know, just turned my life around with food first and then diet for a small planet. At the Noyce Foundation, it's a perfect fit for me and my personality because we believe in movement building, and our mission is for an ecologically just and ecologically sustainable and socially just society. And so we go through it through food, because food is really where nature touches culture. It's where nature is transformed for, you know, value for us as society. And that's also where you see cultural expression. And so at Noyce, we believe that people who are affected by something would be the stakeholder. If you have skin in the game, you'll be in it for change, right? And so the most affected people are the ones that where you really want to invest your dollars if you're interested in making social change. So for us, it's been an evolution. We started off focusing on family farmers because part of, you know, what they're doing in Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street and all these Occupy movements, that's just been the story in agriculture. It's that one versus the 99. It was a more diversified system when you had family farms. That wasn't that long ago, like the 1950s. The corporate concentration and what I'm talking about, the story of externalizing costs onto the environment and labor and small farmers has been the story of food. So if you want to be able to explain and make real this whole Occupy Wall Street movement and how it connects with people, it's the everyday act of eating, because the structure has changed and it's now this corporate concentration and it's impacting globally, but you can certainly tell the story in the United States. We got a farm bill happening right now, so there's an opportunity for change and there is a growing movement. And just like I said, it does include these people who are most adversely and directly impacted. And we got lots of stories with them. I still have a minute, so let's see. As I told you, the right story. So I think I'm going to take that time to tell the story of John Oganowski. Because September 11th just passed. How many of you have ever heard the name John Oganowski? Okay, that's a shame. Because he's a real American hero. I first met John in, when did I meet him? Well, okay, John is a farmer in Dracut, Massachusetts, who's no longer alive. He's from Polish descent. His grandfather came over to this country, and the other American farmers literally helped him raise the barn and all of that. And John eventually inherited the farm. It was 150 acres. He also was a U.S. Air Force fighter pilot and trained as a nuclear engineer, actually. But his passion was farming, and he always kept that farm. And he became an agricultural advocate. And one of the issues that he cared about and got involved in the most as a leader was around immigrant farmers, because his grandfather had come from Poland, and that's how he had gotten into this vocation that was so important to John. And so he became a mentor farmer for an organization that the Jesse Smith Noyce Foundation funded called the New Immigrant Farming Project, and it was run out of Tufts University. So I funded the New Immigrant Farming Project, and we always were concerned, and it was to help integrate the Hmong and Cambodian immigrants who had that farming heritage. I mean, they were really good farmers in their countries of origins, and they wanted to continue farming. And so John was a mentor farmer for one of their projects, which meant that of his 150 acres, he set aside, I don't know the number of acres, but sizable plot of land for the immigrant, for these Cambodian farmers to come on his land and farm. And I had been in his kitchen, and it was a year later, and the coordinator of this project invited me for a tour with other funders so that they could see what they were doing and what was going on with this next generation of farmers. You all might have heard that the average age of farmers, in an average farmer in America, is approaching retirement age. It's like 55. You know, and there's a concern about who's going to feed America, you know, because farming isn't profitable and there's a lot of problems with it. And so there isn't this. Anyway, so he was addressing this by allowing these immigrants on his farm. Well, I had been invited out, and 9/11 happened. And the next day, I wasn't planning to go because I'd been there the year before, and I live in New York City, and this is way out in Massachusetts, and I have a family. I didn't want to travel, so I decided not to go. And, you all heard about 9/11. Well, the next day was a very powerful day, right? You're trying to live after this event. And, of course, I didn't go to work, and I was at home, and I opened my computer, and the first email that I read was from this guy, Hugh Joseph, who was the coordinator for this immigrant farming project. And he writes about driving to the Oganowski farm and hearing about the airplane hitting, or just that something happened, and then continuing to listen and hear the rest of the story, and then finally arriving to the house and hearing that it wasn't just a small plane, it was a commercial airline, and in fact was an American airline. And, you know, like, wow, you know, just getting out of his car and going into the house and seeing Mrs. Oganowski on the phone crying and thinking, because John was a pilot, that maybe she knew the wife or somebody who was, you know, on the plane that had crashed into the World Trade Center. And then she hung up the phone and literally collapsed on the floor. And he thought, it's not the wife. What happened to John? John was the pilot. They slit his throat so that Mohammed Atta could take control of the plane, because John would have never flown that plane into a building. He would have crashed into the water. So they killed him. And after that, there was this anti-immigrant tidal wave, you know, that happened in our culture. And I always felt that John's life, this white guy, this is just this big, he looked like a farmer, you know, like broad shoulders. He had, I think, three daughters, built his house himself, you know, had given his land to these Cambodian immigrants, because he saw them as the future for food in America. That was his vision. So that was the story I wanted to end with. And I hope, you know, we get to talk about the big picture of food, because I think that's where the story needs to be told, actually.
Thank you. Bueno, buenos días, y quería comentar un poco de nuestra historia también, que nosotros también tenemos historia como diferentes personas, como cada uno de nosotros.
Good morning. We just wanted to share a little bit of our story, because we know all of us have our different stories.
Bueno, yo soy parte de una organización de trabajadores agrícolas. En Imokali estamos a 2 horas de aquí, donde un grupo de trabajadores empezaron a organizarse básicamente para eliminar lo que es la explotación que existe en la industria agrícola en la Florida.
I'm part of a farm worker organization, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and Immokalee is based about 2 hours to the west of here. And we got our start as an organization to confront the exploitation which existed in the fields where we harvest.
Desde el 93, trabajadores en este tiempo los robaban por una semana, 2 semanas de salario, no les pagaban, o también salían lastimados trabajadores, se enfermaban parte de pesticidas también en la industria agrícola.
We got our start in 1993 as a result of much of the violence that was taking place, workers being beaten in the fields, likewise the sicknesses that arose from the misapplication of pesticides, and also the instances where workers might work, you know, several weeks and never be paid for the labor they had performed.
Y en ese tiempo trabajadores dijeron, tenemos que organizarnos y vamos a pedir un diálogo con los rancheros. Del 96 hubo huelga de hambre parte de 6 trabajadores pidiendo un diálogo por 30 días y también hubo paros laborales por una semana parte de 3,000 trabajadores.
Throughout the 90s, we organized different actions to try to have basic dialogue with the growers who employed us. In 1996, we had a 30-day hunger strike that six workers went upon. We also had a labor stop, a strike, which 3,000 people participated in within our community.
Y la respuesta de los rancheros era, decían de que alguien preguntó por qué no quieren juntar con los trabajadores.
But the response of the growers was embodied by the response of one grower when asked, well, why won't you just meet with the farm workers?
Dijeron, te voy a poner de esta manera, un tractor no me va a decir a mí cómo manejar mi rancho.
He said, let me put it to you this way, a farmer doesn't allow a tractor to tell him how to run his farm.
Era una respuesta como los trabajadores totalmente eran como una herramienta.
It was a response that indicated that farm workers were nothing more than a mere implement.
Después de esto, vimos otra estrategia. Mejor sabíamos también que las grandes corporaciones que compraban tomate en la Florida también tenían un poder grande.
But we learned that the major companies that bought these tomatoes, the retailers, had tremendous influence over their suppliers.
Por ejemplo, de los restaurantes de comida rápida, ellos compraban tomate por mayoreo en la Florida, bajo precio y de calidad.
And we know that the fast food industry, for example, had long-term contracts where they demanded low-cost, high-quality tomatoes from the growers in Florida.
Y ese es el problema, que no había un aumento a los trabajadores. Por ejemplo, una cubeta de 32 libras le pagaban de 45 a 50 centavos el promedio.
For example, a 32-pound bucket of tomatoes, we get paid 45 to 50 cents on average for every 32 pounds.
50 centavos, y es el mismo precio en los años hace 30 años, por ejemplo.
And for 30 years, it's hovered between that range of 40 to 50 cents without a real wage increase.
Y también en eso, cuando fuimos directamente con las grandes corporaciones, también era un parte muy grande de los consumidores, que también daban como el poder a las grandes corporaciones.
And we realized that it's the consumers that really give the power to these major retailers who actually have the influence over the industry.
Empezamos a hablar con diferentes universidades, iglesias, y nadie sabía dónde venían los tomates o en qué condiciones que vivían los trabajadores.
We began to talk to people at different churches, congregations, schools, universities, and very few people actually knew where their food came from or the conditions within which these tomatoes had been harvested.
Y lo que pedíamos para grandes corporaciones es un centavo de aumento por libra de tomate y el centavo que va directamente al trabajador. Y también un código de conducta, que es lo más importante para nosotros.
And what we wanted is for these retailers to pay more money for their tomatoes so that farm workers would get a penny per pound wage increase, as well as for them to sign a code of conduct that protected workers' rights within their supply chain.
Empezamos en el 2003 pidiendo a Taco Bell nada más.
We began in 2001 asking for Taco Bell to sign on to these agreements.
Que sabíamos que era el más grande de cadena de restaurantes, que es parte de Yum Brands.
Because we knew Taco Bell was a part of Yum Brands, which is the largest restaurant company.
Logramos la campaña durante 4 años. Taco Bell vino a la mesa y pagar un centavo más y crear un código de conducta donde ellos compran su tomate.
And after 4 years of a boycott, Taco Bell conceded and agreed to pay more to increase workers' wages by a penny a pound, as well as to sign on to this code of conduct.
Y hasta hoy en día tenemos a 9 corporaciones que pagando el centavo y también vigilando por sus trabajadores que hacen posible para llegar el tomate.
And so now today we're working together with 9 multi-billion dollar food companies that have agreed to pay extra to help raise wages by a penny a pound, as well as to have a code of conduct that protects workers' rights.
Tenemos a McDonald's, Burger King, Subway, Whole Foods, que es un supermercado de comida.
So we got McDonald's, Burger King, Subway, Whole Foods, others.
Y Sodexo, Aramark.
As well as Sodexo and Aramark.
Y bueno, con la colaboración de Bon Appetit y Compass Group, cuando ellos llegaron a apoyar la campaña, hubo más presión a los rancheros.
And when groups like Bon Appetit, as part of Compass Group, came on board, that helped to generate more pressure on the growers in creating these changes.
Y el año pasado, los rancheros, el 90% de los rancheros de la Florida también llegaron a la mesa diciendo, vamos a trabajar con ustedes.
And finally, this past season, we reached an agreement with 90% of the tomato farms across the state to change conditions in the fields.
Y el año pasado también, en la temporada pasada, empezamos a implementar un código de conducta donde todos los trabajadores deben de ser respetados, tanto como cuando uno trabaja entre los pesticidas. Hoy en día, el trabajador tiene derechos si siente que hay pesticidas, no tiene que trabajar.
And so as part of these agreements, workers actually have the right to speak up. For example, if there's pesticides that are being sprayed in the fields, workers don't have to work there. They can stand up for themselves without the fear of being fired as a result.
Y esta temporada también vamos que tener implementar todo este acuerdo como más de 33,000 trabajadores.
And so this coming season, this new agreement with the code of conduct and the penny per pound increase will impact 30,000 to 33,000 tomato pickers here in Florida.
Pero nuestra campaña sigue presionando ahora los supermercados, tanto como de la Florida y a nivel nacional.
But our campaign continues because now we need to enlist the support of the supermarkets here in the United States.
Que
hi, everybody. My name is Helene York, and I actually have a different title than the one that's in your program. I'm now, as of last week, the Director of Strategic Sourcing and Research for a Bon Appetit Management Company. Somehow, a goddess of good practices didn't make it to my business card. But I like to think that that's my title. I'll tell you that. Anyway, so we are a food services company, and we've been involved and taken leadership positions on food-related issues for decades. And why do we do this? We've worked on antibiotics in animal husbandry, sustainable seafood, humane certified eggs and meats, the code of conduct. We were the first food service company in the nation to work with the coalition of Immokalee workers. Why are we a little bit different? Well, some people think it's because they know we serve the food at Oberlin College and Wesleyan and University of Pennsylvania, and they assume we serve only liberal colleges. Not true, actually. There was a recent report of the 10 most liberal and the 10 most conservative colleges in the United States, and we were equally represented on both of them. It's not because we serve a lot of college students. For every activist in the Real Food Challenge, there are 9 to 15 students who want Fruit Loops for breakfast, pizza for lunch, and a burger for dinner. That's not really where it comes from. It's not because we're a California company. We are based in California, but we have operations in 31 states. I would say that the real reason we're different is because we care about food. We care about the flavor of food. And unfortunately, that's really uncommon in food services, where cycle menus are the norm. What do I mean by cycle menu? Every so-called chef that runs a restaurant in a corporation or a college or a jail or an oil rig or whoever is hiring a third party to manage food services is told what they are going to serve, who they're going to buy it from, and they're given recipes. And we don't do any of that. And that makes us a restaurant company, and that's where our company is really different. It's now 25 years old, and I proudly tell you that our CEO, who founded the company, won the James Beard Award last week. First time ever anyone in food service for visionary leadership in the field. His reason for creating this company was to get rid of mystery meat. Some of us, if you're older like me, you remember mystery meat from college. It doesn't exist to the same degree as it used to, and it does not exist at all at our accounts. We hire executive chefs, and we require them to actually cook and to understand our initiatives. I give a monthly webcast education series remotely over the Internet, and we really keep our chefs informed and expect them to keep our workers informed as well. I guess over the past 7 years that I've been involved in sustainable food movement through a company, we've learned at least 3 big things. And the first is that it's all connected. If you have antibiotics or antimicrobials in meats, you have bad animal welfare practices. That reduces the genetic diversity in the food system. Then you have bad food products. They all kind of look and taste the same. That leads to horrible conditions for workers, whether it's on the farm or in the processing plant. And all of that also leads to nutrient runoff in waterways. It is all connected. The second thing that I've really learned as the supply chain director is that partnerships between individuals rather than bands of consumers or large businesses is really where we're going to make a change. I partner with NGOs, I partner with scientists, I partner with academics, I partner with small producers, medium-sized producers, even some of the big guys, because they're all part of the food system. It's not about me, it's about the strength of the partnership and how we are able to affect change. And many times I hear advocates say, it's all about what, if consumers only knew what they needed to know, change would happen. I respectfully disagree. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. Even if they want it, they definitely want to make sure, we have to make sure that the food is available. And I would say the third thing, very mindful of my last 21 minutes, this is my 21 seconds, this is my timer, is that we are increasingly focusing, we as a company really need to connect the newer producers, the smaller scale producers, the supply chain middlemen to make this happen, to make this work. And this is hard stuff to do. And we do this because if we don't have, let me give you one story as my parting shot for right now. Community-supported fisheries. If you live on a coast, you've probably heard of them. They're wonderful ideas, bringing fishermen boxes, giving, you know, selling them to groups of subscribers like a CSA for produce. The only problem is most people don't know how to fillet fish. And so what they do is they drive their individual cars to the dock, sometimes long distances, pick up their boxes, take them home, you know, not well fillet fish, and half of the biomass gets trashed. This is a beginning. People have to become familiar with new flavors. They have to work with smaller scale fishermen. But the real issue here is how do you make that whole supply chain more efficient? And what we're doing with our Fish to Fork program is that those same fishermen are delivering 100 pounds to one location where their first fillets, then their ceviche, then their soup, and I'm obviously talking about the little bits at the end, and then their compost. And that's where we create change by creating efficiencies in that supply chain.
One of the things that I think in the title is about plate-centric, right? So that's the wonderful thing about food as a driver for broader environmental and social change, right? Because we're talking about movement building and, you know, everything is problematic right now. And the thing about the food system is that people do have a direct relationship with it through what they eat and their plate. And that is not just a superficial thing that should be written off, because it is also motivated oftentimes by issues of health, you know, and this sort of how our bodies are reacting to all these toxins in our environment that make food more important and all of that. And at the same time, it can also have a limiting aspect where you don't think about where the tomato came from. You know, you're just thinking about the flavor. And I think that what has to happen is, you know, to tell the big story about the broken food system is combining, you know, the cultural stories. It's like, what is the right relationship to food with the story of what is, you know? And that is, you know, you think about the food system, you think about the production, it's the climate. It's climate change, it's the disruption that's happening with these changing seasons, right? Because the food system at base is the sun and water and sometimes soil and sometimes the water, the fisheries, you know, that we heard about. And then labor. And then labor is where you get into these issues of and production, right? And it's really the transformation of you know, if you think of it like maybe Marx would, you know, like that's where we interact with nature to create value and then to try to profit off of that, right? So those are some of the things that when we're enjoying a delicious meal that brings us together around the culture and helps us connect to the spirit of the food. I mean, there are spiritual traditions now. You'll see that there's interfaith groups like what Jordan is involved with that are thinking and the kosher tzedek movement, right? So that this meat and these foods are supposed to be sacred, and yet typically they've been produced in inhumane for the animals and also inhuman for the labor ways. And so I think that's the challenge for journalists, is to not just focus on the story about the garden, but talk about the farm bill, you know. Not just talk about the exciting things happening in a city, but this global impact of, you know, fuel versus food, genetic modification of seeds, really corporate control of the food system, where now there's four companies that control 80% of the meat production. And that type of, and that's mirrored in every commodity, because it's really a commodity system. And the problem with that is that we need resilient systems, because we're facing a time of unknown changes due to climate change, and that's going to impact very directly our food. So we need a resilient food system. And a food system that's so concentrated is vulnerable, is really not a resilient food system. You have a loss of biodiversity, so you have less of a genetic stock. Don't think that genetic engineering is expanding the genetic diversity and making us more. It's doing just the opposite. Okay.
Oh, gosh, I think Coley will love her because she's able to put everything into perspective. Where is it I come from is on the ground level. And we're having our struggles right now. And the only thing that I can say around food is if you come away with anything today, come away with it with the thought of it, just like Coley said, it's more than just food. It's about everything that centers around it. Our older elders, our grandfathers, grandmothers used to do an old traditional method way of gardening. And we may have to, and that's what they're saying, we may have to go back because of the change in the permaculture way of doing things. And that is a method that will not change, but it's a very good method way of doing things, and we are now looking into those ways. So that's mine.
Bueno, nada más como en Guatemala, por ejemplo, hace años todo tenía un sistema como nos enseñaron desde con los abuelos.
In Guatemala, for example, we had a system that we learned from our grandparents of food production. Thank you.
Pero hoy en día como grandes corporaciones están llegando como de minera en diferentes lugares de Guatemala.
But there in Guatemala too, there is these massive corporations that are arriving to do things like mining that also have impacts.
Donde hoy la minera viene como contaminando los ríos y la gente no puede producir sus propios vegetales que estaban antes.
For example, with all these mining companies coming in and then polluting our waters, we're no longer able to produce the food like we once were able to for generations.
Entonces, ¿qué hacen estas personas? Tienen que comprar en el otro sistema de comida, no sé si es producido aquí o producido en otro país, que llegan a vender comida.
And that obligates farming families there in Guatemala to purchase foods under new systems that which they hadn't purchased from before because they're no longer able to produce their own food.
Entonces, la gente tiene otro, o piensan que es otro sabor de comida y mucha gente a veces se enferma.
Many people think, oh, it's a new flavor of food that we're going to be trying, but they find themselves getting sick by eating it.
Hasta incluso animales que hemos visto como han muerto simplemente tomar el agua que años por años que eran utilizados para personas.
And we've seen animals that have died from drinking this water that for many hundreds of years have always drank from these sources of water.
Entonces estoy pensando como más tiempo quizás va a ser otro sistema de comida en diferentes áreas rurales de Guatemala.
And so I fear that there's going to be a different system of food for those that live in rural communities in Guatemala in the near future.
Just want to talk about two things that I see coming up that are generally referred to as good things because we can see them and they're tangible, but there's a lot of implications that may be negative on the other side that are less obvious. One is there is certainly a movement in the United States to improve animal welfare, and I explained before why I think that's very important. It's really the trigger into a much more environmentally, ecologically sustainable system of producing meat. But what's happening is a lot of the big producers are beginning to do a much better job here, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that they're exporting their really bad practices. Some of the really big companies are moving their operations to places like Poland and China, where there isn't a spotlight on them, there isn't free press, and they are putting a halo around themselves because they're doing better practices here, but they're making it much worse where their growth is occurring. Another thing is calorie counts on food. New York City has really taken the lead and in putting calorie counts on fast food. And, you know, on first pass, this is a great idea. And I will tell you that once you see it, you expect it on everything. And we have a lot of clients who are saying, oh, put this on all of your food, put this on all of our food. Well, we don't have the same product in every location. We have 400 different restaurants. We have 500 chefs. That means we have 600 opinions about what is actually on is being served. And so to count all of that is something that discourages experimentation. It discourages working with the small producers. You have to bring in commodity things, commodity sizes, very regulated things, which actually is against a sustainable food system. So this connection between calorie counts, which scares away a lot of 20-year-old women in college, I will tell you that, because they can't put it into context. What does that mean, that an entree is 230 calories? That sounds like too much. I think I'll have a 100-calorie snack pack instead. There are implications to that, so I just wanted to bring that up. The question was related to cost and how much more does it cost to eat good food, essentially, or to produce good food. That is a really, really difficult question to answer, but let me tell you that it does cost more at this time from the consumer level. if our clients don't subsidize it. So for a lot of our accounts, our clients, so we're hired, we're a contract company. So the Getty Museum will hire us to do the food there. Reed College hires us to do the food there. And it really depends on the structure of the deal. But on the other hand, there are ways that we make it less expensive. We have smaller portions because we think that's more environmentally and socially responsible. It also then means the plate cost is a little bit smaller, is a little bit less. We buy better quality meats than most companies, and we pay very strict attention to the antibiotics. We will not buy meat that has been grown with subtherapeutic antibiotics, and that does cost a little more. On the other hand, over time, like certified humane eggs, cage-free eggs, we went in making a commitment, and it brought all the other service providers online. So over time, the costs went down. So we have no monopoly power. We serve 120 million meals a year. Sounds like a lot, but Americans as a whole eat a billion meals a day. But if we get in there, make a lot of noise, we tend to change the supply chain, and the costs come down over time, or at least they stabilize so that the bad stuff's about the same as the good stuff, if you will.
Bueno. En caso de nosotros también ha sido mucho lo que es la pregunta, ¿cómo le afectaría a los consumidores si los supermercados pagan un poco más por el tomate?
And that's a question we get a lot of times too, is how much will it cost the supermarkets if they're willing to pay to increase wages by a penny a pound?
Lo que nosotros estamos viendo es de que estamos pidiendo un centavo por libra de tomate que un trabajador pizca.
And so again, we're asking for workers to get a penny a pound raise.
Pero si preguntamos a los consumidores, ¿tú pagarías un centavo más por cada libra de tomate si compras en Publix, por ejemplo?
And we ask consumers, if they go to Publix, for example, to buy their tomatoes, would they be willing to pay that extra penny?
Estamos seguros que van a decir que sí, estamos dispuestos a pagar un centavo más, porque los consumidores, en este sentido, a veces no ven cuando aumentan ellos y cuando bajan el precio.
Because consumers observe regularly the fluctuation in prices that might go up, might go down, so a penny seems like hardly anything.
Para que un trabajador puede vivir dignamente, no le costaría nada a un consumidor.
And to know that a worker can labor with dignity, I don't think is a big cost in the minds of most consumers.
Pero para un trabajador, un centavo es mucho para nosotros.
But for us as farm workers, it actually means a lot. And if I might just add, too, to do the kind of math, you know, a tomato bucket weighs 32 pounds when it's filled with tomatoes. So that penny a pound actually has the potential to raise wages 64% if you're paid 50 cents a bucket. So even though if you're at, you know, Trader Joe's or Publix or Kroger, all these stores that have refused to pay the penny per pound, you know, it might raise costs from $2.50 a pound of tomatoes to $2.51 or $2.52. And yet for workers, that's a potentially 64% wage increase after three decades of stagnant pay.
So part of the question of cost also relates to the reality of subsidy. And the biggest part of the farm bill, almost 70%, is the nutrition title of the farm bill. And what used to be called food stamps and is now called SNAP, it was actually the most effective part of the stimulus, I think, that Obama gave. It really expanded, and now facing the next farm bill, even with more people in poverty, there's a real chance that the number of SNAP benefits is going to be under attack, or it is under attack right now, actually. But those benefits can be used to buy healthy food, and they can be used to buy whole foods. There's also WIC. And there's been changes in the last, I don't know if it's 8 years or what exactly, where many states have, that there's a requirement in the basket of what you have to provide. If you're a WIC, so if you accept WIC in your store, there are a range of foods that you have to have available for purchase. And it has expanded to include fresh produce. And it used to not include, and it didn't have to include fresh produce in the past. And then right now there's also a program that's being supported by some foundations and other entities called the Double Bucks program. And there's you can use food stamps in farmers markets. The problem is then, is the food more expensive than other places that you could get fresh fruits and vegetables if you get them at all? And so the Double Bucks program doubles the value of your food stamp if you're using it in a farmer's market. And that's a program that was used throughout Michigan and I think other places like New Orleans and some other sites, and it's being evaluated right now. And it's by the organization that's been running that program is called the Fair Food Network. So that's another potential thing that could be expanded as a result of the next farm bill if we had the will to do so.
The inverse of that question then is the cost of the cultural and social costs of eating food that is not good. Maybe you can address that.
Well, because of the geographical boundaries of where our Muscogee Creek Nation lies, majority of our people live in low income areas because they choose not to move out of their areas because of, you know, too many ties. They've got a lot of ties to their land. So we have a lot of food deserts, and people are not eating healthy. They're not eating fresh foods. We've got a lot of rural people. That's one thing that we're looking at. We're just now looking at as tribal people through our Food and Fitness Policy Council to address those issues. Culturally, our people like to eat foods that are typically that grandma and great-grandmother fixed for us. When commodities was introduced back after the removal, the federal government had a responsibility to live up to some of the treaties. And one of them, they've never really lived up to any of the treaties, but they gave us commodities. And when our people, that's all that they had during that time. Commodities was lard and flour and all those processed foods. We're the product of the commodity era. And we're just having to change that time and change those ways. And we've got a long road ahead of us. But we've got the right players at the table to do that.
Bueno, creo que el problema viene desde hace mucho tiempo, cuando la Florida no quería eliminar lo que son los casos de esclavitud aquí.
I think the problem dates back a long time, even going back to the legacy of slavery here within Florida agriculture.
años por años los trabajadores no tienen voz aquí en la industria agrícola. No puedes reclamar tus derechos, por lo que te van a hacer es despedirte del trabajo.
Workers have never had the right to speak up or to defend their rights because they would be fired if they tried to do so.
Y el salario, por ejemplo, ahorita llegó que el trabajador gana de 10,000 a 12,000 por año.
On average, farm workers working full-time make $10,000 to $12,000 annually.
Hay muchas personas dicen, pero ¿por qué las mujeres trabajaron cuando estaban embarazadas?
Many people say, well, why is it that the women were working in the fields while they were pregnant?
Pero es una necesidad para esa mujer. Si no tiene que trabajar el día, lo van a sacar de la renta porque en el sistema aquí cobran por semana.
But it's a necessity to work because if you're not actually making money, you're going to be kicked out of the trailer where you live, and so people need to make money.
¿Cómo vas a comer durante el día?
How are you going to eat?
Entonces las mujeres están obligadas de trabajar aunque no quieran.
And so the women are obligated to actually work while pregnant, even if they don't want to.
Porque no existe un sistema donde tú puedes decir no voy a trabajar hoy, voy a estar descansando y voy a trabajar hasta que cuando estoy bien.
Because there's no system in place to accommodate those needs for women that are pregnant.
Y no hay un trabajo garantizado en la industria agrícola.
Neither is there actually guaranteed work any day for workers.
Y hoy en día para nosotros estamos en un nuevo día porque ya tenemos un código de conducta.
And for us, we see that we're in a new day here, given this agreement signed last season.
Donde trabajadores hoy en día tienen el derecho, por ejemplo, si antes tú podrías trabajar en este lado y en el otro lado sprayando.
Whereas in the past you might be working here and then, you know, when you move to this section of the tomato fields, they spray it with pesticides, yet you're still forced to work.
Y ahora el trabajador tiene ese derecho de decir no vamos a trabajar.
But now under these agreements, farm workers have the right to stand up and say, no, we're not going to work there. It's sprayed with pesticides.
Y vamos a crear también lo que es un comité de salud y seguridad en las compañías que va a ser dirigido con los trabajadores.
And these agreements with the farms also provide health and safety committees comprised of workers where they can defend those rights.
Pero necesitamos que los supermercados también presionen a los rancheros cumplir con esos reglamentos.
But we need the supermarkets to come on board and lend their support to demanding these changes.
Lino, how do you think though that the the consumer will make the connection between the work that you do and these workers' rights and their buying, purchasing power?
Porque como cuando nosotros empezamos pidiendo a las grandes corporaciones, vimos una conexión muy grande del consumidor y un supermercado, por ejemplo.
You know, we've seen that the power that consumers have to make possible the profits of these supermarkets and other retailers.
Porque ellos simplemente atraen a los consumidores con un simple anuncio.
Through advertising, they're able to attract their customer base.
Y el consumidor nada más lo ve, nada más lo bueno que existe de una corporación o un supermercado.
And so then the customers only see the good side of these companies that they present.
Pero si un consumidor pensaría de dónde vino el tomate, por ejemplo, cualquier comida, en qué situación viene, cómo lo plantaron, vas a llegar en un punto donde vas a entender un poco más cuánta conexión tienes con esta comida.
But when consumers are actually given the opportunity to learn about the reality behind the food that they're eating, how it was produced, the conditions in which the worker worked, then it starts to change things.
Entonces, por eso nosotros queremos que los consumidores también presionen a los supermercados porque somos que damos el poder.
And that's why we're looking for consumers to build up the support to get the supermarkets likewise on board.
Thank you. Thank you. Gracias. Is there anything anybody else wants to add? Kulu, if you're going to, while you're talking, maybe you could talk a little bit, too, about the purpose of funding groups like WIDA as part of the foundation.
Oh, so sorry. Well, as I said, our mission is for a more ecologically sustainable and socially just society. So, and you know, I also said that, like, our theory of change is about movement building. You can pass some laws, but if you don't have an engaged and broad-based social movement to hold policymakers accountable, the laws will never be implemented or enforced, and they won't have teeth. And we've seen that happen with the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And if you don't have a broad-based movement, you won't get the laws changed to begin with, and we saw that with the climate change legislation that went nowhere because environmental funders and their darling multi-million dollar, you know, top big green environmental organizations, probably many of which, you know, do a lot of good things as well, but failed to engage a broad-based movement of regular people, not just high-income, well-educated, mostly white people. And the truth is that there is a lot of engagement already going on at the ground, at the grassroots level, and that's why we fund community-based organizations, and that's why we believe that, like I said before, people with skin in the game are in it for change, right? Like, if you're being hurt, you will want, hopefully, at least some percentage of those in that category. And the folks being affected are communities that, you know, are on the dumping end with this commodity foods that Rita talked about that have contributed to the diabetes. I mean, there's a direct scientific, you know, connection to what you can metabolize and what causes high blood sugar levels. And it's what our government is poisoning our own people. They're still doing genocide against Native Americans. Okay, that's what Rita is telling you. The Trail of Tears is not over. They're crying where they are, which is in the dust bowls of Oklahoma, you know, with climate change. It's been very dry, that's what she's saying. So we fund them because they have skin in the game. They're going to want change. And we also, we fund a support organization of the Coalition for Immokalee Workers called Just Harvest USA. And they're also targeting the good food movement. You know, all those foodies out there and trying to say, okay, humane animal treatment is really important and we're down for meatless Mondays and all of that. And, you know, we also got to care about the workers. Because the workers are in that juggernaut. They're the majority of the food system. They're in the belly of the beast. That most of what exists is bad, okay? As much as the organic and alternative and local is hot right now, it's still marginal. And so it's the farm workers, it's the processing plant workers, it's the restaurant workers who are actually going to be the ones who do drive reform in the dominant food system. And so that's where we want to fund. And it turns out that actually a disproportionately high amount of that workforce is people of color and immigrants. And so we have a very diverse portfolio when you follow that funding strategy. Labor is an important aspect of our funding strategy. And we do it because we think that that's what drives change.
I am, well, I've talked to a number of people involved in community-supported fisheries, and I think that's rather a grand term for CSA boxes, basically. But they're very new, and I think many of them have a lot of promise, but most of them aren't there yet. There's some really good efforts in the Northeast. There are now several on the West Coast. And there's one in the Washington, D.C. area that Sam Fromart started, the author of Organic Inc., who's now very much into seafood and artisan bread, who I talked to earlier this week. Olivia Wu, who is the executive chef at Google, which is one of our accounts, has put together a tremendous program. But I think that there is... You know, this isn't going to become efficient until people really, first of all, are willing to try new flavors. You know, Americans eat 17 pounds of seafood on average, and 80% of it is shrimp, which is imported in almost all cases, and farmed. Canned tuna, which is almost all imported and in trouble. Salmon, which is mostly farmed but also from Alaska, and then some form of regionally appropriate whitefish, but increasingly is tilapia from Asia. So that's what we know. That's what we think is as fish. And there's so much genetic diversity off our coasts, especially South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Chesapeake Bay, that's the promise. That from my perspective as a sustainable seafood advocate, I like the idea of community-supported fisheries as a first step. They're inefficient now, but they are serving to remind people that seafood is seasonal and that local isn't necessarily sustainable, depends on the gear and the permitting and everything else, but it's a darn good start. And for those of us in institutions who are beginning this effort, we're going to help make it a little bit more efficient, hopefully teach everyone else, and I'm excited about it because I love seafood.
We have about 2 minutes left, so perhaps it's a good time for anybody on the panel to say anything they'd like in 30 seconds or less, so we can end up.
Well, I just want to reiterate, tell the big story of food. You know, I think it's really important, connected to that movement that's going on about 1% versus 90%. It's the story of food. Talk about resiliency. You know, they say that worldwide agriculture and food systems responsible for a third of the greenhouse gas emissions. A lot of that comes from livestock, and people are saying, you know, folks in China and India and just all around the world are going to eat more meat. It's really catastrophic for our planet, for climate change. Is not just the climate, it's what we eat. It's the whole planet. So I think that's that connecting. I mean, if you want to make climate change real for everybody to be in a movement to help save the earth, if that's what motivates you to be an environmental journalist, tell the story of food. Make it intelligible that this is a way that you can solve this crisis, and that there's actionable steps to be taken with passing the Farm Bill. Does it make sense? We have a Farm Bill. Okay, I mean, say it really fast. What we're told to eat is actually good for the planet. It's a lot of fruits and vegetables. It could support a more regionalized food system. Guess what? 0.4% of the money that gets through the Farm Bill goes to support those things that we're told by the same agency that gives the money for fatty, sugary, processed food that's killing us and causing climate change. Okay, they're putting most of the money into that. And then they subsidize with food stamps the consumption of fatty, salty, processed foods that go to the commodity program. You know, we could change that. That's because of policy, and it's hurting the planet. It's an environmental story. I beg you to tell it.
Absolutely.